Nature's Archive Podcast, a Jumpstart Nature production.
If you're a longtime listener, you're already familiar with the remarkable world of galls and the Gall Week community science events that have taken place in the past. But today, we're taking a fresh look at galls with a specific focus on the importance of spring galls, which our guest, Adam Krantz from gallformers.org, describes as the most scientifically interesting galls. Okay, for those of you who haven't heard the past episodes, that's all right. The first 31 minutes of today's episode is entirely new content, but I've appended our first conversation with Adam at the end so you can catch up. Plant galls are unique organs induced by a variety of organisms, ranging from wasps to moths to midges to mites to fungi. These organisms have figured out how to modify a plant's genetic expression for the benefit of its own life cycle. It really is magical. Today, Adam tells us why spring galls are, as I had mentioned, perhaps the most scientifically interesting and have the most opportunity for new discoveries, possibly even by you. And I really enjoyed how our conversation strayed into broader ecology and phenology topics, too. Galls certainly have a lot to teach us. Spring Gall Week is from April 15th to 23rd. Yes, that's a bonus weekend added to it. And during that time, be sure to get out and look at your oaks, hackberries, hickories, and other plants to document the galls that you find and put them on iNaturalist. I've included a link to the iNaturalist project in the show notes to make it easy for you to get involved. And a huge thanks to Dr. Mirav Vanshak and to Adam Krantz for continuing to coordinate these events. So without further delay, Adam Krantz discussing spring galls. All right, Adam, thank you for once again joining me on Nature's Archive.
Sure, glad to be here.
So I think I could probably retitle Nature's Archive at times as Gallcast because the topic of galls comes up so often.
As it should.
Yeah, they're lots of fun and they're great entry points, I think, for people out in nature to dig a little bit deeper. I'm hoping today we can revisit a few things about yourself and gall formers, galls in general, and some exciting happenings that have occurred over the last 18 months or so since we spoke last. So for listeners who maybe have missed some of the prior discussions on Nature's Archive, can you remind us what a plant gall is?
Absolutely. So a plant gall is a novel organ that's composed of plant cells expressing plant DNA according to a plan or a design imposed by an external inducer. So that could be a wasp, a midge, an aphid, a psyllid, a fungus, but it's orchestrating some new organ, some combination of plant tissues that the plant would never produce on its own.
That's a much better definition than I use. So I'll have to work on integrating that into how I try to explain it. What might a gall look like? How and when and where do people typically encounter them?
So the wonderful thing about galls is that they have a hugely diverse array of different shapes and forms, right? Like a lot of things in nature, of course, that are designed to fit different ecological opportunities, to take advantage of different opportunities. So mostly you find them on a particular set of host species that have a high diversity of galls. So we have oaks are the absolute number one gall host group. And then hackberries, hickories, goldenrods. And then beyond that, there's many other sort of host genera that have fewer galls. But yeah, they're found during the growing season on all sorts of plant parts above and below ground.
The thing that always surprises me when I think back to my personal progression in nature is how I missed galls for so long. I'm thinking that I had to have seen them as a kid and just probably didn't think much about them or assumed it was a disease or something that I was just able to dismiss. But it's this natural history aspect that makes them so fascinating. How did you personally get into galls as deeply as you have?
So for me, it was through Charlie Eisman's book, Tracks and Signs of Insects. So that book has chapters on all sorts of miscellaneous structures that are created by insects and other arthropods that aren't the actual organisms themselves. And one of those chapters is dedicated to galls. And I sort of was looking through the whole book, looking for all sorts of things I could find outside and realized that galls were sort of that one chapter. And of course, this is true of all the chapters, but it was just sort of giving me this pinhole view onto this much, much wider world. And I started looking on iNaturalist at the number of observations that had gone unidentified and realizing that, okay, I could start taking responsibility to identify some of these. And then I just kept going further and further and building. And now it's taken over my entire life.
So at some point you started digging into some of the historical literature, like the Weld books and other books. Can you walk me through in a little more detail that progression? Like, when did you find yourself actually looking at these texts from 1950s?
So what happened basically was that I was looking at Charlie's book, right, in his little, the few pictures he has in his chapter there. And I would go on to iNet and I would say, hey, Charlie, is this correct? Hey, Charlie, is this correct? Hey, Charlie, what's this? What's this? What's this? And he was eventually like, you can just go look. This is all I know. Here's the book that I got all this from. You can go look at it yourself. And so I started spending a lot of time with that book and building some very simple tools using the iNet guide tool to list that information. But then it was actually one of our collaborators on iNet, Kimberly Sasan, who pointed out to me that all of the original descriptions of all these species were available on the Biodiversity Heritage Library. So that was a watershed for me that opened up this huge flood of other new information that made the project of organizing the information available that much more intimidating and that much more exciting. Because if we had all of these original descriptions in one place that we could search by host, by different traits, then suddenly it would be so much easier to see what was out there, organize that information on iNet, improve the computer vision tool, all these stuff, all these accomplishments that were sort of appealing to me at that point became that much more possible if we could have a way to organize that information.
I think I hear several success stories here in this narrative, one being Charlie's book in the first place, which opened so many people's eyes to many different aspects of nature. And then your work, and do you have any metrics on iNaturalist as to how many species have been added to computer vision because of this increased focus? I know that's probably a little fuzzy number.
No, I don't have a number that I can actually give you. If I would estimate, it's got to be over 100, potentially in the couple hundreds.
Even if we don't have a specific number for that, certainly you've helped cultivate a fervent community on iNaturalist. So you can post a gall and typically get some feedback on it pretty quickly from other individuals out there.
Yeah, I've been very satisfied, very pleased with the results that we've gotten so far.
So why don't you give us a little more insight into Gall Formers, which is the searchable database. I'm not even sure how to characterize it. It's more than a database, but the resource that you've created to help Gall enthusiasts.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I was getting to this point where I realized we had all this information, and it was just not conveniently accessible in the ways that I imagined it could be. And so I was going on the iNat forums and basically making posts like, hey, how can I make the iNat guide tool? So for people who don't know, the guide tool is a deprecated feature that was launched with minimal possibilities quite a while ago, early in iNat's history. And I was like, hey, I want to do more stuff with this. And Kenichi basically said, this tool sucks. You're never going to get anywhere using this. You need to start from scratch. You need to build a real website. And so I didn't, of course, feel like I had the skills or experience necessary to do that. So I was sort of casting around at random on the iNat forums, hey, how could I possibly go about solving this problem? I got really lucky to find Jeff Clark, who was basically the exact right person I needed, right? So he was interested in galls and he had exactly the skill set to build a website. And he had just taken some time off from his software development career and he was exactly positioned to build this thing with me. So we built this a few years ago. It is a database essentially, right? It's a user interface for a database that contains a page for every known described or undescribed gall in North America. So Canada, US, Mexico, and a little bit of the Caribbean. And it's essentially both an ID tool and a literature review tool. So it collects quotes from every primary literature source, every secondary literature source we can find. It collects images from iNat and from the literature, and it has a searchable tool that you can use different ecological traits like the host plant, the color, the shape, the form, all sorts of things that you can observe in the field about a gall to let you know what the possible species names that correspond to that might be.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out at this point too, you say that it includes every described and undescribed gall in North America. It's worth also saying that there are many undiscovered galls out there as well too. And how do those discoveries, which seem to happen on a relatively frequent basis, how do they then work their way into gall formers?
So just to clarify, including every species, every described and undescribed gall is an ambition. It's not something that I would say that we've achieved yet. But yeah, so in terms of how do we get an undescribed gall onto the page, it's through iNat. Every once in a while, people will email me with something new and I'll say, please put this on iNat. Because when you have an iNat record, right, it's something that the public can look at and search and find, and we have a place to discuss it. It's got all of the metadata attached to it. It's just much more convenient to do it that way than to do it through private communication. But yeah, once people put it on iNat, then they either alert us or we find it using the ID applied by the computer vision. And yeah, I create a page for it. I create a temporary tag, and then we start to accumulate information about it. If we see other people find it in future seasons, we tell them, hey, this is undescribed. Can you try to collect it so that we can get it to a taxonomist? And that's pretty much the process.
Actually, on a personal note, you say collect it so you can get it to a taxonomist. What is the current state of the world when it comes to these specialized taxonomists that can actually, say, take in some of these species and do the hard work that it takes to describe a species?
That very much depends on which group you're asking about. In gall-inducing taxa, we've got mites, we've got fungi, we've got midges, we've got wasps. So in some groups, there is sort of like a single lifelong expert who is retired or near retired and is not in a situation to be replaced by a younger apprentice or something. Where, so if we were to lose one of these individuals, it would set us back tremendously. Or if they've already retired, there's just no one to step up and do that work instead. In the oak gall wasp, partly for that reason, become my main obsession lately. We actually have a pretty big and growing and young community of taxonomists working on those organisms. So that is partly why I've shifted my focus there, because I know that if I tell people to collect things, that I, at least in theory, will have someone to send that to over the next 5 or 10 years at most that will get it published and put a name on it.
Very interesting. So yeah, basic research is such an important facet of biology. The other thing that I noticed about gall formers that maybe wasn't the case when we spoke last is that you have some look-alike species in there as well. Can you tell me more about that?
Are you talking about like scale insects and stuff?
Yes.
Yeah. So the problem is that, of course, that most people don't know what a gall is at all. And even people who do know what a gall is will often, especially when they're early in their gall natural history lifespan, will overgeneralize and think that things that are look like galls, so plant organs that are strange or structures like scale insects or burls, will mistake them for galls and go looking for that on gall formers and come up empty. And we don't want them to think that those are unknown or undescribed structures. So I did at one point start adding a few scale insects to the hosts that I had tried to add like a complete list of galls to. At this point, I have mixed feelings about that. I don't know if it's actually worth putting those in there. I don't know. Interesting to hear if anyone has actually benefited from that or not, or if they just get in the way.
I can tell you my opinion. I enjoy it. And the one little bit of feedback I would have, and maybe it's changed, I haven't looked recently, is it on initial search, it wasn't always clear to me, say I'm searching by Quercus agrifolia or something like that, and the options will pop up. It wasn't clear to me which were actually galls and which were gall-like structures. But then once you click in, you can see it's clearly identified as not a gall. But yeah, I like it. That's one data point for you.
Yeah. And I suppose ultimately, right, if you're identifying something on INAT, right, and you find something that matches, it doesn't matter whether it's a gall or not. You put the right tax on there and you've got the species of the genus name down.
One of the reasons why I reached out to you right now when I did is because there's a new event coming up, a spring gall week. And those, again, who have listened to Nature's Archive in the past, that we've profiled the fall gall week before. So I thought it'd be a good idea to explain why spring gall week is such an interesting idea and potentially a very useful community science endeavor. So can you tell me about the genesis of spring gall week?
Sure. So we've done gall week for 2 years now. And we've done it in the fall both times. And of course, there's a very big diversity of very apparent charismatic galls to see in the fall pretty much anywhere in the country or the continent. And they tend to last for a fairly long time. So they're easy to find, they're easy to identify, they're well studied. But the flip side of that is that most of the understudied galls, the understudied gall-inducing organisms, are emerging, they're active, or they're forming galls in the spring. In the case of the oak gall wasps specifically, these are organisms that have a, to our knowledge, almost without exception, a two-generation life cycle every year. And they have one generation called the agamic generation that only includes females. And that's the generation that is typically found in the late summer through the winter. They typically have galls that persist for a long time. They're charismatic, they're large, they're easy to find. And then the other generation is what we call the sexual generation or bisexual generation that has both males and females. And in oak gall wasps, the sexual generations typically occur on young spring tissue. So buds that are either about to break or have just broken, young leaves, young flowers, or young stem tissue. They're typically pretty ephemeral. They're typically pretty cryptic. So they're very understudied. If we have the opportunity to get everyone on INAT or some very small fraction of everyone to go out and look for galls at some particular time, the most scientifically interesting time to do that is in your local spring. And of course, when spring is depends pretty considerably on where you live. So we split the difference and we put gall week in the middle of April. So when a plant is perennial, it overwinters, right? It tucks all the resources down in the roots and then all the leaves drop or the stems die away or whatever. But then in the spring is that period when it's taking those stored up resources from the roots and it's very quickly developing a lot of new tissues. Now, of course, for a gall inducer, their whole life cycle or lifestyle is premised on creating novel plant organs. So that's the moment, right? That's the big opportunity to create these new organs. Is in the spring when all of these resources are on the move and creating new organs very quickly. Some of these things I've seen here in Texas over the last couple of weeks, right? New undescribed sexual generation galls that have emerged over the course of, you know, a week and a half, some of them even less than that. So really, in terms of spring gall week, what I would love to say is spring gall week should be spring gall week in wherever you happen to be. So it's right now if you're in Texas or Southern California or Florida, but it moves across the country. So we picked gall week in the middle of April to say we'll catch the end of the late spring galls in the south and the early spring galls in the north, and hopefully that will be good enough.
Yeah, I think here in California, we really need like a gall season because we were starting to see some early galls as early as mid-February. And I'm guessing there were probably some that were already going before that.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
This event, I know, has generated specific sub-events like gall walks at different parks or open space preserves and things like that. And we're organizing one here, of course, to more than one.
Wonderful.
To get people out. So hopefully others can do the same in the future. Mm-hmm. I'm getting a picture of why spring is so hard, because part of it is because things happen so quickly in the spring.
There's
all these pent up resources. I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think some of it might be too, that spring for a gall former is sometimes earlier maybe than we think of spring being.
I mean, I guess it depends on what your benchmark is for spring. If you're looking at the early flowers, then it's around the same time. So, you know, here in Texas, I was taken off guard that spring was starting in the middle of February. It sounds like in California, it's starting even earlier. But yeah, I mean, there are other sort of stereotypical spring events that are happening at the same time. But the spring galls are synchronous with bud break, right? So if bud break is what spring means, then it's happening at the same time.
Yeah, that's probably a little bit of my own bias coming in, because I guess my naive view of the world had traditionally been that insects came in warmer weather, but there are many insects that will come out on a sunny day that's in the 40s. So it can happen sooner. So that bud break and then the tiny gall wasps will come out at the right time to take advantage of that bud break.
Yeah, it's the thing with sort of niche partitioning is that if most insects do come out when it's warm, that means that there's an advantage in being the one that can, whether you're avoiding predators or you're just finding food resources that aren't available to others, if you can tolerate the cold, then there's an advantage to that.
When it comes to the spring gall formers, like we've been talking a lot about the cynipid wasps, how does it look for some of the other inducers like the midges or the mites or sawflies? Are there similar uncertainties or discoveries to be made in the spring?
So I've been mostly focusing on phenology with snippets just because it's been my sort of personal obsession lately. So I can tell you about hackberries, for instance, as an example, and hickories, where on hackberries, there are two diverse groups of gall inducers. There's the psyllids and the midges. And the psyllids are all spring. They're all on young, fresh, emerging leaves. And then the midges occur in the mid to late summer. The same thing is true on hickories. We get the psyllid fauna, the aphids, phloxera in the early spring as the leaves are emerging, and then the midge galls in the summer. And that actually mirrors a pattern that we see in the oaks, where the sexual generation galls and the psyllid galls on hackberries and the phylloxera galls on hickory, all of them form integral galls inside of the leaf tissue or stem or flower tissue. Whereas the summer galls, both in the hackberry midges, the hickory midges, the oak gall, agamic generation, are much more likely to be detachable. So they fall off of the leaf before the leaf falls off the plant, or at least they can in theory, but they're structured in such a way as that they're not attached to the leaf permanently.
That's interesting. I love hearing those observations because it immediately brings to mind different ideas or hypotheses as to why that might be the case or how that could be advantageous.
Right. So the number one thing is the management of the microclimate, right? So a gall is not a perfect, since it's not perfectly sealed from the environment, right? So the inducer is shut up in there, but if the external air gets too dry, then the organism will dry out inside. So essentially, it's all about finding that ideal microenvironment for the gall to mature in. And of course, in the spring, the leaf persists on the plant long enough for the inducer to leave. In the fall, the leaves drop and the insect needs to overwinter. So the theory is that the detachable galls are supposed to be dropping before the leaves so that the leaves will cover them, so that the galls will get buried in leaf litter and they will stay at a relatively high level of humidity and constant temperature over the winter.
Yeah, makes sense. So I love to get into interesting natural history stories, and that's a good example there from a general standpoint. But I'm curious, with all of your engagement in the gall community, have there been any surprising gall discoveries in the last few months that you want to highlight? Maybe natural history stories related to galls that you've discovered or that people in the community have discovered that you've become aware of?
Well, I mean, we could talk about the one that you found.
Yeah, I'll give the quick story of what I found, and then you can tell me how you helped me figure it out. So it's actually somewhat of a funny story. I was supposed to be leading a bio blitz, and I went on the wrong day. And I got there and was like, where is everyone? And I was kind of disappointed. But then I thought, well, you know what? This is an opportunity to actually go out and explore on my own. And I can probably look at things a little bit differently when I'm not trying to lead a group. And I found this coast live oak, Quercus agrifolia. And I noticed American winter ants all congregating on a bud. I mean, ants are small, obviously. The bud is small. So I was lucky to have noticed it. But it stood out to me from experience simply because I know that typically the ants on that tree, anyway, if they're in the tree, it's because they found a source of honeydew. And honeydew is usually an indication of herbivory or some other interesting ecological thing happening. So, of course, my first thought was maybe this is a gall, even though it just looked like a little bud. So trying to be a good iNaturalist citizen, I took some photos, stuck it on iNaturalist. I put it in the gall projects. I don't even know if I flagged it as a cynipid at the time, but I did get it into the gall projects. And then at that point, you took a look at it, and I guess you can pick up the story.
Sure, yeah. So you were not certain, like you said, if it was a cynipid or not, an oak gall wasp. And I think I remember telling you, actually, that oaks can't exude honeydew on their own. That in order to have a nectary like that, they need an inducing organism to impose one on them, which of course I believe to be true for maybe another week or two until I went out and it was spring here and I found post oaks and lacy oaks doing the same thing without any apparent herbivore damage, just exuding honeydew on their buds. But it turned out in your case, of course, that it was potentially a described gall, one that we have never seen before to our knowledge. It's something that was mentioned in the literature. We have some drawings of it. We have some text descriptions of it. We have one not particularly useful photograph of it. And so the current name is Cocosynaps attractans, indicating that it attracts ants using honeydew. And so I asked you to go and collect them and dissect them to prove that there was in fact a gall wasp larva in there and to see what the internal structure looked like, to see if it matched these drawings that we have. And I guess at this point, the verdict is still not 100% certain. We're not quite sure if that's what it is or not. So you collected those. What's the status?
Yeah, I did dissect one, and there was a chamber and there was a larva inside, a single larva. So it did prove, in fact, it was a gall. Now, as to which one, I wanted to be careful because the fact that this was something that hadn't been frequently observed, I didn't know how rare it really was. So I went back and I wanted to make sure there were sufficient quantities of these galls on that tree and neighboring trees before I would collect any to rear beyond just the one. But I collected three or four and nothing ever emerged.
Yeah, it's too late. You either collected them too early. So that's the sort of the whole trick, right, is figuring out the timing. And the only way we can do that is to have more people try and fail, right, just like with anything. So that's sort of one of my hopes with Spring Gall Week, is that we can get people not only out looking for spring galls, right, to just to report them at all, but for one thing, looking for people to actually collect people, especially farther north, where this is still earlier in the spring, to look for the agamic females that are still emerging from last year's galls that are ovipositing on the buds as they're breaking. We'd like people to collect those so that we can try to figure out what they are and tie those to sort of phenological and geographic records, but also to collect the cryptic spring galls and the ephemeral spring galls, because those galls, because they are ephemeral, they're actually quite a lot easier to rear than the agamic galls, right? Some of the agamic galls take 1 or 2 years. Of course, there's always a possibility that they're just going to die in the meantime if you don't provide them the right conditions. But the sexual generation galls are, they have such a short time span that you pretty much know within a week or so if you've done it correctly, if you've collected them at the right time. And basically, the idea is you just take them and you stick them in a Ziploc bag, you stick them in some sort of jar. They should be airtight, watertight, because they need to stay humid, right? Those galls still rely on the tree to stay moist. If they dry out, they won't survive. So that's been a mistake that we've made in the past, that we've learned that it's better for them to get moldy and stay wet than it is for them to completely dry out, because the insects can't tolerate that. So that brings me to a point I neglected to mention earlier. The main project that I've been working on for gall formers over the last 8 months, almost a year now, is a phenology tool, which is secondary to gall formers as a website. It's something I built on my own through a different platform. It's designed as a way for users, amateurs, and professionals, academics, to basically see what information is actually known about the timing, the phenology of gall development and emergence for each different generation of each species. So that tool is something that I hope will be very useful for people in actually figuring out what is going to be around in my area during Gall Week, or when should I start looking? If I want to find something outside of Gall Week, when do I need to look for any particular species or genus that I'm aware of? And a lot of those are going to be sexual generations that we know a very little bit about. We have a very small sense of when they should occur where, but so designed this phenology tool to try to extrapolate from known information to other latitudes where we have less information. And what I'm really hoping is that people can use that tool and just go out and look and see what they find to start to help me fill in more of the tool so that we can iterate, we can accumulate more data. So the idea is that the tool tells you all of the current data available for any particular species. In practice, of course, that's not even close to true, because there's a tremendous amount of data available on iNaturalist that I have to manually go through and code in order to import it. So I've got something like 26,000 data points in the tool right now. There are many hundreds of thousands of observations left on iNat to import. But that's the hope, is that people will use that tool, go out and find things that will help me fill in some of those gaps, correct some of the overestimates or underestimates that are in the tool now, so that in the future, we can make even better predictions about when to look for particular species, when they develop, when they emerge, when they oviposit in any particular area.
That sounds really interesting. And in the moment we start talking about plant phenology, it's pretty easy to take another step and say, well, this will be interesting too from a climate perspective to see how things change over time, because you know a lot of trees are notoriously adaptable and will start breaking bud very early if the weather's warm, and it'll be interesting to see then like how do these gall inducers adapt to that variability over time too.
Yeah, I've worried about that in creating this tool, because a lot of what I'm doing is of course essentially just collating all of the historical records, and in gall studies we had a period from maybe 1860 to like 1920 or 30, where most of the original descriptions were made, and then sort of a lull throughout the second half of the 20th century that resumed more recently. But to some of that older information, how much does that still hold up? How much of a guide can that be to us today after we've experienced, what, a degree or so of warming already? So far, essentially, we don't have enough information to make precise enough estimates that a degree of change so far is like detectable relative to the precision of the estimates I'm making in the first place. So I don't know if we'll ever be able to say using galls specifically, right? Oh, this species has shifted by an average of 3 days because we just don't have the historical baseline data to compare to. That may not be true, but that's my guess right now, is that we just will never know.
Hey, nature enthusiast, do you want to be part of something bigger? Well, we're building a movement at Jumpstart Nature, and we've just added some new volunteers to help with our podcast and website. But this means our costs are going up too. I need to purchase software licenses to give them access to the production tools we use. For example, one media editing license costs $21 a month. And this is where you come in. Please consider supporting our mission by contributing to Jumpstart Nature through our Patreon or direct contributions, or even purchasing some logo merch. Check out all these options at jumpstartnature.com/donate, also linked in the show notes. Not ready to make a financial contribution? Then please share this episode with 3 friends. Sharing what we do is actually one of the very best ways you can help us. Thank you all for your continued support.
Yeah, maybe it wouldn't be something so precise as that, but rather a correlation of a decline in occurrences of a given gall as the phenology of the plant shifts or something like that, which of course is one level of indirection, which inherently makes it a little bit less reliable.
I mean, that's a really interesting question. I was just thinking about in terms of the reaction of the tree to climate change versus the reaction of the wasp. I guess I don't really know. So some of the live oaks around here, for instance, are 80, 100 years old. What is it that they're actually doing to adapt to climate change? I don't know if an individual tree like learns to bud out earlier, or if the learning happens on the scale of the species through genetic change. Because if it happens on the scale of genetic change, then those wasps are not going to have any issues because they're creating 2 generations per year. And the ones that emerge too early or too late are going to die, and the other ones are going to produce huge abundances. As long as the hosts still exist, right? If the hosts are able to adapt, then the wasps, I don't think, should have that much trouble keeping up.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about for sure. And the temporal plasticity, I guess, is the key point there. Definitely, I'll make sure to link to the phenology tool and, of course, gall formers and gall week. We should probably call out exactly when gall week is.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought last night I should memorize those dates and then I didn't. And now I don't want to say for sure. I want to say 15 to 23.
That's right. Saturday, April 15th to Sunday, April 23rd. And in traditional gall week form, it's more than a week.
Yeah, with 2 weekends.
So that will be a lot of fun. And there's a iNaturalist project, of course, to collect the observations that you may have. So Adam, is there anything else about the magic of galls that you would like to convey today?
I just hope people go out and look and find interesting things and collect them and send them to me. This might be a bit of a gauche thing to say, but one of the major sort of obstacles I run into in iNet users is that naturalists have a hesitancy now to kill things. And for us entomologists, you know, that's the only way that we can ever really learn is by having specimens in hand. So collecting things, stick them in the freezer, pin them, put them in ethanol, whatever you do, but just having people be more willing to actually make collections is the only way we're really going to advance our knowledge here.
I think like anything, there's a spectrum of behaviors that could exist in that realm. And I think people can do what you're asking for in a thoughtful way. And Charlie, back to Charlie Iceman, he has a good blog post on rearing leaf miners. And I think a lot of the same principles apply as to how to collect and store. So I'll make sure to link to that in the show notes as well. That can be maybe a quick overview for folks who are interested in contributing in that way.
Yeah, I think I have a post written up similar to that as well that I can send you to link.
Oh yeah, definitely. I'd love to see it. Okay, well then, Adam, thanks again for taking the time today. And as always, I enjoyed our conversation and I look forward to getting this out in time for Gall Week.
Me too. Thank you for having me.
And as promised, here's the first episode with Adam Krantz, recorded on September 14th, 2021. It was episode number 29. And in this episode, there's a little bit of content that overlaps with what we just talked about, but we get much more into galls and their natural histories and how to find them in the field, as well as the formation of gall formers. So stay tuned. Hey, everybody. Before I get into the standard intro, I just wanted to say that I'm super excited about this episode. As naturalists, one of the most fascinating areas of study is plant galls. I hope you get a taste as to why that is today. And you might note that my voice is a little, well, off. I do have a head cold, so hopefully it isn't too distracting. Or maybe you actually like this voice better. If so, let me know, but I'm not sure there'll be much I can do about it. So my guest today is Adam Krantz. Adam has a BA in Environmental Studies from Lawrence University in Wisconsin and a Master's of Science in Natural Resources and Environmental Science from the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. His thesis was on insect pest ecology and diverse agroforestry plantings, but of late he's taken a special interest in plant galls. He's since founded gallformers.org, which is a website designed to be the authoritative resource for all plant galls of the United States and Canada. We start out discussing a bit of background about how Adam got into galls and how gallformers came to be. If you're listening now and wondering, what's a gall anyway? Well, these are beautiful and sometimes bizarre growths on plant tissues induced by another organism, such as a wasp, a midge, or many others. They often develop vivid colors and evocative shapes, and all have fascinating natural histories. These growths occur specifically to support the life cycle of the inducer, and are often induced in amazingly precise ways that you'll have to hear to believe. For example, Adam explains how the larvae inside the gall may steer the plant response throughout the entire lifespan. By the way, I have photos of several of these amazing species in the show notes and on my Instagram at Nature's Archive. You've really got to check them out. We also discuss strategies and techniques for looking for galls in the field. They are quite common throughout much of the world, and many can be easily identified. We discuss some of the attributes of a gall that might help you to identify them, when and where to look, what you can do to improve your chances of an ID on iNaturalist, and we talk about some of the other plant growths that might be confused with galls. And as if the crazy shapes and colors and interactions weren't enough, it turns out there's still a lot to learn about galls, and they're a great area of focus for naturalists looking to discover and describe new species. Adam also gives a nice overview of three extremely interesting galls that are among his favorites. Each of these have fascinating natural histories, including peculiarities like hollow centers with free-rolling cells, and what might be considered a gall threesome, where a second centipede wasp comes along and entirely changes the gall's developmental trajectory. Of course, Adam describes this in a much more scientifically accurate way. You can find Adam and Gallformers on Twitter, at Gallformers, and Adam on iNaturalist, at Megachild. So without further delay, Adam Krantz. Adam, I really appreciate you joining the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So the topic of galls, I think, is really of a lot of interest to a lot of naturalists. And for me here in California, we're in peak gall season right now as we're recording this. So I'm really excited to have you today and get into the fascinating natural history of galls. Before we dive into that, however, I want to understand a little bit about how you found galls. And maybe we go way back. And how did you get interested in nature in the first place?
I actually came to natural history from an activist political angle. I was into like anarchist, anti-civilization sort of politics as a high school kid. And that sort of gave me this idea that nature was something that I needed as an expression of my personal values, get to know. And like that led me to, once you start studying nature, the interest of it takes hold on its own. At that point in my life, I've been interested in nature, but never really got all that far as a natural historian. And so for me, it wasn't until actually I discovered iNaturalist after grad school that I actually started making headway as a natural historian on my own. So it was the computer vision, which as many of your listeners probably are familiar with, the computer vision on iNaturalist provides suggestions about what, you know, your observations are. And that just opened up this whole world. It made it the sort of frustrating, difficult activity of finding out what all this stuff I was seeing actually was. Finally, that dam broke. And I was able to get off and figure out what these things actually were. And that was really exciting for me. And it kind of took over my life at that point. So ever since, I've been kind of obsessed with using iNat. And after that, I was getting into different things. I got Charlie Eisenman's book, Tracks and Signs of Insects. And I was focusing on all the sorts of different things that he talks about in the book, leaf miners, eggs, and pupae, and all these sorts of different interesting things that you see. And I realized that of all of those things, plant galls were just this massive world that his book like barely scratches the surface of. And that in terms of the expert community on iNat, there wasn't anybody out there who was focusing on this. And there's just all of this work that needed to be done in terms of identifying old observations and making new species and all of this stuff that once I started doing that a little bit, it was just a rabbit hole where it kept getting bigger and bigger. And I realized how enormous this project was actually going to be in order to take care of this stuff. And it's been an obsession for me ever.
Yeah, when I had Charlie on the show, in fact, he said that each chapter of his book could be an entire book in and of itself, which he has gone to prove with his Leaf Miner online book. In fact, I think each chapter of his book could be a whole volume, a set of books. And I wanted to back up real quick to the computer vision, the CV
part of mm-hmm. iNaturalist. As I understand it, that is the machine learning aspect of iNaturalist, where there are reference photos that then inform the identification suggestions that iNat provides. From some of our prior discussion in preparing for this show, it sounded like you were actually working to fill in some of the gaps there so that the computer vision could be improved for gulls. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one of the things I found really exciting at first when I started using iNat, is that I realized that there were a couple of really common things that the existing computer vision was already able to identify for me. But then I was finding all of these sort of underobserved species that were still relatively common. And I thought, what's it going to take to make it so that in the future, those observations would be identified correctly? And I talked to the people on the iNat team and realized that you just needed to get over a certain threshold. They needed a minimum of 100 observations for each species to get them included into the next training batch for the CV in the future. And so that was really motivating for me, you know, of the species that I already knew, to go out and find more observations in my area, take more pictures, upload them, but also to go through and identify other observations that would get to that goal from other people in other parts of the country. And like I said, once I started doing that a little bit, I realized, well, there's all these other species that aren't even on the site at all. It's just this huge backlog of literature and all of these observations that are waiting for identification that somebody just needs to come along and put in the time to connect those.
So I had no idea that there was a threshold of 100 observations. Is that research grade observation?
There's some particular details to it. I don't want to go on the record with specifically what those are. It's something like 50 research grade plus a minimum of 10 observers. Is it some traits that they apply to make sure that it's diverse and stuff?
Yeah, that makes sense. You could have one person misidentifying something 100 times and you wouldn't want that to necessarily go into the computer.
Yeah, so they have some safeguards to avoid that.
Makes sense. So you've taken this interest, like you identified this niche that needs more help, and you've actually now developed a site called Gullformers. Gullformers.org is where you can find it. Can you tell me about what that project is, what your goals with that project are?
Yeah, like I said, when I discovered that there's this huge sort of literature, so maybe 100 years ago, people were pretty interested in the natural history of gulls. There's a lot of publications in the academic literature. There's a fair number of popular publications. And so these were all out there. You can access these all on websites like the Biodiversity Heritage Library. Most of them are public domain. But naturalists today basically don't know these books exist. So I knew of one, the Weld book about cinnipid wasps I got from Charlie Eisman. But other than that, nobody seemed to be aware that all these publications had been released, that this information was freely available. And so the goal of our website, Gullformers, is basically to take all of that primary literature information, and for one thing, just to make it like conveniently available for a naturalist today by combining it with an ID tool that lets users search by field obvious traits, right? So if you're looking at a gull on a plant, if you can identify that plant, and then you can answer a few simple questions about what that gull looks like, where you find it on the plant, what color it is, season, stuff like that, basic field traits that don't hopefully require a ton of expert knowledge, then that ID tool is going to present you with a short list with good pictures where available that are going to let you easily identify that species that you're looking at in the field. So that's one of our main goals. And then our other goal is to then expand that literature. There's quite a few publications documenting gulls from the past 150 years or so, but the work is by no means anywhere near done. And it's actually an area that if you're a naturalist who's interested in finding undescribed species or contributing to the sort of frontier of scientific knowledge, gulls are a great place to do it, because we have, even in places that are relatively, you would think, relatively well studied, a lot of undescribed species in North America. It's a great place to contribute to knowledge there. And our website hopes to facilitate that by collecting and organizing observations of undescribed gulls.
So I know it's a relatively new site. How much progress have you made at this point, and what do you see as next steps?
Sure. So we got started around the beginning of 2021. We've been building the site on the technical side and then filling in data for maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 months now, sort of a pretty active way. At this point, we have almost 2,000 gulls listed on the site. Of those, almost half of them, so about 1,000, are oak gulls. And we have a complete set of all of the described oak gull species from North America. So yeah, at this point, we're just trying to fill in that database, expanding out to other host plant genera and just looking for other observations to fill in and taking more things from the literature.
So for anybody listening right now that wants to help contribute to Gullformers, what can they do to help?
Sure. So Gulf Formers is by amateur naturalists for amateur naturalists. So none of us are experts. We're not in academia necessarily. And we're all people who are just trying to find information about galls and build this sort of collective area of knowledge. One thing that helps us, obviously, is just for people to observe galls and put those observations on iNaturalist or a website like Bug Guide, where we can find them and see if they contribute to the knowledge that we're trying to build. But if people are interested in going beyond just being an observer, we're definitely looking for more people to contribute to the site as admins. So maybe pick off an area where you live or a taxonomic group that you're interested in, and to find the literature and to fill in the gaps in our database, because our project is pretty ambitious and it's never going to get anywhere close to complete unless we have interested active users who are helping us fill in that data.
And is the scope North America?
Yeah, so our intended scope is the U.S., the continental U.S. and Canada, although we do have a little bit of a few species that we include from Mexico and other parts of Central America. The problem is that once you get outside of the U.S. and Canada, the literature is much thinner relative to the diversity of species. And so we just end up having a lot of undescribed species, which isn't undesirable, but it makes the website less useful than it is in the U.S. and Canada. So that's our main focus.
That would be such a huge undertaking as well. I can only imagine if you're talking a couple thousand known species here, then you expand that to places like Mexico or the tropics or the whole rest of the world. There's got to be tens of thousands.
Yeah, if you look at oaks alone, the diversity of oak species going from the U.S. to Mexico, it like doubles. And that makes everything so much harder because galls are so host specific that you need to have a species identity for the host, and people don't know how to do that. And we don't know how to help them do that. Less resources available. It's just much more difficult.
So we've been talking about galls as if everybody knows what they are, but haven't really addressed what they are, how they're formed, things like that. Can you tell me, what is a plant gall? How do they form?
Sure. So a plant gall is basically a novel organ of a plant that can only exist because the plant develops in a way that's guided by some other organism. So we call these inducers, gall inducers. They can be all sorts of things: wasps, midges, mites, aphids, fungi, even nematodes. All sorts of different taxa have developed this strategy. And basically, it's a form of herbivory where the plant is induced to create a structure that protects and feeds the inducer. So it's an alteration of the plant's development. It's not. People often make the mistake of thinking that galls are some kind of a tumor or like a scar tissue that's developed in response to like feeding damage, which is something you often see with other kinds of herbivory. But galls aren't that sort of like a chaotic response, right? A gall is a specific design that the plant creates using plant genes to a design created by the inducer. That's tricky to wrap your head around, but the idea is that it's plant genes. Plants are supplying the sugars, all of the compounds that create the gall. It's just that they're expressing those genes in a way that the plant could never do on its own.
Yeah, and I guess that sort of interaction then explains why for individual species, the galls always look pretty much the same. The morphology ends up being consistent across different individuals of the same species.
Yeah, absolutely. It's part of, I guess, what you call the extended phenotype of the gall inducer. It's just that includes not just the plant itself as the niche that organism lives in, but specifically the genetic information of that plant that they're altering as a part of their life history.
So you mentioned there's a number of different families of organisms that can induce galls, and they can also induce them in a number of different places on a plant as well. Are there any insights, first of all, like where do you typically see a gall? But are there any thoughts as to why certain strategies maybe are taken on to choose a certain location for a gall?
So we find plant galls on all different parts of host plants. There are leaf galls, and this is part of what our ID tool at gallformers.org is built on, so that there's this long, very specific coevolutionary relationship that you need to have in order for an inducing organism to specifically play these plant host genes in the right order, in the right way to develop this novel organ. Right? It's not something that you can just move from one plant to another, but it gets a lot even more specific than that, because the genes that they're stimulating, the structures that they're creating, can only be created on particular parts of the plant. So some galls can only be formed on plant stems. Some are found on flowers, some are on fruit, some are on the roots, different parts of the roots, rhizomes versus other parts of the root, just the root crown. And then on the leaves, you have galls that are only found on the angle between the veins. Some galls are only found in the upper side of the leaf, some only in the lower, some only in the midrib. And so we take advantage of all that specificity to facilitate our ID tool to tell people where or what species they're likely to look at, be looking at based on where it is on the plant.
If we were to maybe look at, say, let's pick centipede wasps as one focal area for this, can you walk me through then when, how, et cetera, that they induce the gall? It sounds like there's a very specific timing that has to be followed here for them to be successful in this.
Yeah, absolutely. Each wasp has its own target part of the plant, but they also have particular seasons and parts of the plant's development. So there's sort of a temporal niche partitioning here, as well as physical. And so a centipede wasp will lay eggs. So let's take a species that occurs in the spring, will lay eggs in the bud tissue before the leaves and stems of the New Year's growth emerge. And then those eggs will hatch into larvae. And those tiny little larvae, this is to best of my understanding, the larvae are primarily responsible for actually inducing the gall as that New Year's growth grows around them. So whether they emerge in the spring or in the fall, those structures develop as the plant tissue grows, and they're constantly changing the chemicals that they're emitting into the plant to update based on what stage the growth of the gall is in. So, it creates the structure at the right time and in the right place and with the right traits that the inducer wants it to have.
So potentially for a spring gall like that, the adult is laying the eggs very early in the season if it's still in bud form.
Yeah. So here in Michigan, I saw a lot of centipede wasps ovipositing in around March, back when there's still snow on the ground. And they're actually a relatively easy thing to observe as well, just the wasps themselves, because they're very slow and, they cluster on the same sort of host plants that you expect them from, the galls. So
that's a good point to start looking early then. And these are typically very small wasps. You said they're easy to find, but they aren't like super dramatic. You have to look pretty close, I think, to see them still.
Right.
And the adults that are ovipositing so early in the year, have they just emerged from the previous year's galls? Where have they been all winter?
Yeah, so a lot of gall life cycles involve pupation and overwintering either on the forest floor inside of a gall. And sometimes this can last for multiple years. So a lot of oak gall wasps, because oaks are, I think this is presumably something to do with the fact that oaks are a masting species. So the abundance of available acorns at any given year might be very different. And this might also be just to avoid cycles in parasitoid or predator abundance. But many galls will persist on the forest floor for multiple years. And then the wasp will emerge from the gall, and then at the time it's appropriate for it to oviposit, will emerge from the gall and go find its target organ.
Yeah, so a number of different strategies then involved in overwintering. And one other thing you said that sort of piqued my interest is the root galls that could be on different parts of the root. And that's just got to be so difficult to actually observe, because I don't think there are many naturalists going around digging up plants to inspect the roots.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's an area where we have a pretty good reason to guess that there are a lot of undescribed or never reported species, just because you don't see them. They're hidden underground.
To your knowledge, has anyone gone out and actually attempted to do any sort of survey?
So I know because oak galls, centipede galls on oaks are particularly well studied, we know that there are quite a few root galls that occur on oaks. And part of that is people looking for alternate generations. So not only do centipedes overwinter in galls on the ground or sometimes in the tree itself, depending on where the gall is, but many centipede species have alternating generations within a year. So they'll have what we call an agamic generation, where there are only female wasps. And then the eggs laid by that generation will contain both male and female wasps. We call that the sexual generation. And those two galls can be extremely different. And so we have something like 1,000 known galls from oaks right now. And of those, maybe over 600 of them are named, described wasp species. And presumably the majority of those wasps occur in pairs. So we know them as 600 different species, but actually there may be only 300 species that we don't realize yet. We haven't connected that they're alternate generations of the same species. So that's an active area of research to try and connect those alternating generations. And a lot of the root galls are alternate generations of species that also form galls on leaves or flowers or acorns.
Yeah, that's just so like mind-blowing and fascinating. You mentioned that there could actually be a reduction in number of species as we start to figure these things out. At the same time, I know there's a number of different factors that could result in splitting of species, and there's all these undescribed species as well. Have you seen cases where there's a gall that looks very similar, say, on a set of Western oaks as Eastern oaks, but it turns out through research, through DNA, I don't know, some discovery that they're actually different species? Or I'm not quite sure what the right question to ask there is, but how do these splits tend to come about?
I think at the moment, most of our galls lean toward, because of the nature of galls as a natural history object, they lean toward lumping rather than splitting. And we will probably, as DNA comes into play more, probably see some of that splitting. But at the moment, I think I can't really come up with a good example for you, because so the problem is that this is something we deal with in areas that are even less studied than the cynipid wasps a lot, where we'll see a gall that happens in North America on a North American native host species. And I can say this looks very similar to a gall that's found in Europe that has a name in Europe, but I have no way to know without doing the actual specimen, the genetic or the anatomical analysis, to prove that these are actually the same species. So I think at the moment we're making some assumptions that things that look the same that are on related hosts are caused by the same species, but there's always the chance that further DNA evidence will prove that was a mistaken assumption.
Just goes to show how much there is to learn in this space. So you mentioned that there's, by far, oaks have the most gall species that have been described. What other plants are prolific, or maybe not so prolific, but interesting host to galls?
Yeah, so oaks are definitely the champion in this respect, as in so many respects, for whatever reason. But in North America, the second place winner by far is the hickory genus. So we have two big groups on hickories. We have hickory midges and hickory phylloxera, and both of those have around 50 species each. And then after that, goldenrod has a ton of gall species. That's something that we're still currently in the process of building out our guide for. So right now, the Gallformers website is comprehensive for oak galls, hickory galls, and hackberry galls. Hackberries are mostly midge galls and psyllid galls, and we have around 50 species on hackberries. And then other than that, there's just a huge list of species that have maybe one or two or five or 10 gall species.
Being so prolific, I've seen oak trees that just literally have hundreds, if not thousands, of galls on them as one example. I suspect that these play an important role in the ecosystem in general, and maybe the food web more specifically. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the known interactions that exist with galls in the food web?
So galls are a form of herbivory. So they're a vector that's going to take resources from primary producers, from plants, to anything that eats them. And so we know that there's a huge community of parasitoid wasps are the primary known predators of gall inducers. So there's mostly chalcedoid wasps and cynipid wasps are going to be found in all sorts of galls, whether they're made by midges or flies or even mites. There's at least one parasitoid wasp species known to inhabit aerophyid mite galls, which is mind-blowing to me because these mites are just so incredibly tiny. You need a scanning electron microscope to actually even take an anatomically useful picture of them. And yet that there's still a parasitoid wasp small enough to make their living specifically seeking these things out. But other than parasitoids, galls are a common target of all sorts of things that eat insects, right? That's one of the big selection pressures in the design of the gall is to find ways to deter parasitoids and predators. And then there's, of course, the incentive. The more effective those strategies are, the greater the incentive for other organisms to learn how to get into them. So we know that mice, squirrels will chew into acorns to get at cynipid larvae. Woodpeckers and other kinds of birds will peck through the woody outer parts of galls to get at the little larvae inside. And we also know that there are actually stories of humans eating galls. I don't know what exactly. This is a time when maybe people didn't have such good food available, but I've read stories in the literature of school kids on their little lunch breaks going out and picking up oak apples, which you hear oak apples. If you don't know what they're like, that might sound like it might be an appetizing snack, but there are these just extremely thin-walled spheres that are just full of strings. Hard to see what the appeal of that would be necessarily, but apparently people have eaten them in the past.
As I understand it, there's a lot of tannins in those, and they wouldn't be too appealing, I don't think, to most people anyway.
Yeah.
You mentioned that a lot of the design of galls is to prevent access by some of these predators. And you know, I've heard some interesting stories. First of all, just looking at some of the galls that I've seen around here, they have these spikes or hairs or things like that that I could see would just make physical access difficult. Mm-hmm. But the chambers where like larvae might be maturing are, as I understand it, also distanced from the perimeter of the gall just far enough to avoid some of the predation. Like there's some of these other, I guess, the coevolutionary arms race sort of activities that seem to be happening. First of all, are these stories I've heard, are they accurate? And maybe you have more you can elaborate on what's been observed.
Yeah, so this is an area that I think is definitely understudied and that we'll learn more as more research comes out. But we have a fairly confident idea that predation is an extremely strong selection pressure on gall inducers, as it is for most organisms, and that we can infer, but maybe not say with scientific proof in a lot of cases, that particular features are, you know, emerged the way they are in order to avoid parasitism. So for instance, one very common strategy in oak galls and cynipid galls is to secrete honeydew, which is something that oaks don't do on their own. They're a plant that doesn't attract pollinators, right? They're a wind pollinated tree. And yet they now have these sort of nectar producing glands caused by the gall inducer that attract ants. And the reason ants and other, you often see in Michigan, I also often see bald-faced hornets, yellow jackets, things like that, that come to feed on this honeydew. And we have reason to believe that the reason that the gall inducers cause this honeydew excretion is to attract ants that prevent parasitoid access, that the ants defend them in the same way that they might defend scale insects or something like that.
So that would be a tip-off. If you see a lot of ants and some honeydew on an oak tree, that's something worth inspecting a little bit more closely.
Absolutely.
So we started to talk a little bit about the plants where the most variety of galls occur on. And I guess for the naturalists out there that really want to go out and, you know, hopefully we can get this published here yet in September. So there's still a window of time to look for galls. So I'd love to talk to you a little bit about strategies, where to look, how to look, those sorts of things. And I guess I just gave a little bit of a hint saying that, well, hopefully we can publish this in September, but time of year, you know, what's the seasonality and how might it change? Like, where would you look? Say, I'm just guessing galls will stick to the leaves when they fall in the autumn. So you could probably look even later into the year still as well.
In North America, as a gall fanatic, you get really familiar with identifying oak trees, not only just spotting them, identifying them to species. Oaks become this sort of like a little delight. Every time you take a walk, you see an oak tree. Oh, there's something I got to go look at. Oaks, goldenrods, hickories, hackberries, roses have a lot of cynipid galls. Grapes have a pretty wide variety of midge galls. Poplars, you'll find a few different aphid galls on. Maples, cherries, elms all have a decent gall fauna in North America. And then just pretty much anything. Grasses don't tend to have much, sedges, anything like that. As far as I'm aware, not the best, most productive places to look for galls, but broadleaf plants. But in terms of seasonality, it's like I said, so with cynipid galls, they have this alternating generational structure. So you'll see a completely different gall fauna if you look in the spring than you do if you look in the summer or the fall. So it's actually never really a bad time to look for galls. But right now in the fall, there's a ton of unique cynipids and other galls that haven't quite emerged yet. In places like California or Texas, you have a much longer time to do that. But in terms of dropping off the leaf, you mentioned, so there's one of the main criteria we divide galls by on gall formers is whether galls are integral or detachable. So on leaf galls and some stem galls, they'll actually fall off the leaf before the leaves fall. The galls will complete their development and just fall to the ground because that's where they overwinter. Whereas other galls that are integral will stay on the leaf and you can find them on the leaves into the winter.
Okay, so that's actually a hint then when you find the gall still attached to the leaf and if you can then identify the host plant, of course.
Yeah, once they fall on the ground, that makes it tough because you don't know where they came from. You have to look around and see if you can connect the gall to a likely source.
So you mentioned that California, Texas, I assume places like Arizona, I know there's a lot of interesting sort of scrub oaks in those areas. Maybe the gall season extends a little bit longer. And here in California, I was going to mention a couple plants that I tend to look at a lot when I go out. In addition to everything you said, willows. I think we see a lot of midge galls on willows here. I have the proper Latin name is escaping me, but we call it a California coffeeberry, and it gets a flower gall in the spring. And the coyote brush is another good one that there's often galls on as well. And that's one of the most common plants that you see in California. So for those listening, those are also ones to take a look at.
Yeah, you guys are lucky. You have a very totally unique cynipid fauna over in California.
It's super fun too. And we get a lot of really colorful galls this time of the year. The spring galls are fun, but the fall galls tend to be a little bit more over the top in terms of their coloration and shapes and so forth.
That's like the base of the appeal of it, is that just the fantastic forms and designs that these inducers have come up with are just so interesting to look at.
Yeah, and I'll make sure to link to a few interesting ones as well. And I know we're going to talk about some of your favorite galls here in a little bit, so maybe we can get some photos of those to link to in the show notes.
Yeah, it's a shame because they're so visual that it sort of can't get it quite across. But I would invite listeners to go to Gall Formers just to browse. You have to put in a host genus. So if you just put in a Quercus or Caria and just look at the shapes, you'll be, I think, quite intrigued.
Yeah, great idea, and fully endorse that. So continuing on with kind of the how to look for galls. So we've covered sort of the when and where and the types of plants. Are there other sorts of growths that might be confused with galls?
Yeah, so we, thanks to the iNet computer vision, we get a lot of these sorts of things that the computer vision suggests, hey, this is probably a gall, and it turns out to be something else. The most common one is burls. So people think that burls are a subtype of gall, but they're actually not. They're more like the normal sort of what you'd imagine as like a tumor or a scar tissue on a tree. People often mistake insect eggs for galls, and maybe more commonly vice versa, different kinds of feeding damage, but mostly it's other plant structures. So if a gall is a novel plant organ, what they're most likely to resemble is something produced by a plant rather than an insect. And so we'll see people confuse different kinds of seed pods or flower buds, things like that, adventitious roots, which are little roots that occur on the sides of stems above the ground. But we've even actually had, I think on at least two occasions now, people have tagged me in observations of rabbit poop and asked me to identify what kind of gall species they were.
I suppose for somebody who maybe doesn't have a lot of experience with galls, some of them are super obvious and you see it and you know it's a gall. Some of them really are cryptic. And I have a number of observations on iNaturalist myself that I've attached to one of the various gall projects. And I have to kind of say, I think it's a gall, but you know, I'm not really sure. And in the hope that an expert can come along and provide an expert eye to the observation. So speaking of observing galls and making them identifiable, what tips do you have for people, say, that are submitting their observations to iNat?
So the first question we're going to ask anybody who submits a gall observation, if we can't tell from the pictures, is to tell us what the host plant is. Whether you're a qualified amateur botanist to do this on your own or not, you can take advantage of the CV, you can take advantage of the expert community on iNaturalist to help you figure out what those plants are. But making sure that you get enough pictures that we can confirm that is extremely helpful. So if you're really confident you know what you're looking at, then fine, you can just take a picture of the gall on its own. But these relationships are so close that without that confident identification, we basically have to recognize it already. And that is actually something that we do a lot. Once you see a lot of galls, you realize this is a very unique structure. And I would know this anywhere, even if I didn't know what plant it was on. And we can actually do it in reverse. We can use the galls as a line of evidence to guess at what the host plant is. And that's often quite fun and satisfying. So it's not just one or the other, right? You don't have to learn all of your host plant ID first before you can do the galls. You can do them sort of both at the same time and contribute to this larger sense of familiarity with the plant community. But other than that, for the gall itself, if you have a leaf gall, we really often, and sometimes always, depending on the taxon, need to see the top and the bottom side of the leaf where the gall is attached. And other than that, a cross-section, so cutting it open to show what the internal structure looks like, is something that is always useful, and sometimes we can't do an ID without it. So if you carry a little knife, or sometimes you can use your fingernail just to see what they look like inside, can be very informative.
Yeah, trap I've found myself fall into. And unfortunately, I still get lazy at certain times. So I'll take a picture of a gall thinking it should be easily identifiable. And I won't photograph, say, the underside of the leaf. Maybe I looked at the underside of the leaf and there's really nothing there. But having the photograph that shows there's nothing there is really helpful to others to help confirm what it was that you did see. I have to consciously remind myself still at this sort of early stage of my naturalist development to take more photos than I think are necessary and more angles. And then typically it works out. But the worst is just to get home and look at something and be like, you know what? I can't really identify that. And I don't have enough data to figure out what it was.
Yeah, it's a tough balance to strike to figure out how much evidence to gather in any one thing versus going out and getting more observations and seeing more different things. You have to learn that over time.
Yeah, that's a good point. Everything's a trade-off. And I guess the other little tip from my own personal experiences here in California, we have a pretty good variety of oaks. Yeah, we focused in this discussion today a lot on oaks. And when I first started, it was intimidating to identify the oaks and to learn how to distinguish them all from each other. And it's one of those things, I think so many things, that when you first start, it seems intimidating, but then you chip away at it for a while and next thing you know, it's not so hard. So I encourage people to just give it a shot, and it's probably not going to be as intimidating as it might seem at first.
Yeah, I think galls are just a great example of that principle in natural history, because some of them are so distinctive and so easy to recognize that it gives you that sort of place to start from.
Yeah, I did something for the first time 2 weekends ago, and that was I took a nature hike specifically looking for galls. Now, I've done a lot of hikes where I'm looking for everything, like any interesting thing, but this time I was fully focused on galls. And it was one of the more enjoyable hikes I've had in a while, partly because I was able to just focus so deeply and observe so closely. You get into that mindfulness zone in observing nature. I never would have guessed I would be doing that a couple of years ago, but I'm certainly going to do it again. With all of this in mind, yeah, I'd love to hear, given all of your experience, you've seen so many different galls in person and through gall formers. I'd love to hear about what some of your favorite galls are and why, and what their own natural histories are.
Sure. So I picked three here that are going to be things that I've seen in person in Michigan. And so the first one is Calaritis quercus operator. And this is one of the few galls that we do actually know both generations of. So in the spring, I first saw this year on the northern pin oak trees in our yard. As the tree was flowering, you get these big, fluffy, they look like big, I said not that big, but they always look bigger to me in pictures than they do in real life. But they look like big cotton bolls on the catkins of the oak tree. And if you dissect those, you find these tiny little individual cells inside where the larvae live. And the wool itself is this sort of beautiful, it looks just like normal wool when you see it from a distance. But if you put it under a microscope or a close digital camera, each of the individual strands of wool is this beautiful, clear crystal, and they look like glass. It's really lovely. And then those wasps that emerge from those catkin galls go to oviposit on the young acorns that develop on other unaffected catkins, and or on the female catkins, female flowers rather, of the oak. And as the acorns grow in the fall, you get these tiny little pips that look like kernels of corn that grow like somebody stuck them underneath the cup of the acorn. And they release honeydew and they attract other organisms. So I think that's cool just because we know that whole life cycle and we can tell how this particular wasp species is taking advantage of the full life cycle of this oak every year that it's going from flower to fruit, and this wasp is coming along for the ride.
I looked it up because I wasn't familiar with that species. And you're right. Like, I thought at least the spring generation looked a lot like fuzzy pink cotton candy. And I could see, you know, to your earlier point about people eating galls and eating the oak apple galls, that would look pretty appealing to me if I were a kid. It would look like something sweet to take a bite of.
Yeah, I haven't tried it. So the other one I was going to mention, the second species, is called the succulent oak gall wasp. So this is Dryocosmos quercus palustris, and it's a very common, very abundant gall found in the spring on red group oaks, so Quercus rubra and other oaks in that group. And they form these little green globs. They're almost perfect spheres. They look like little green grapes. And what's remarkable about them to me is that inside, they're completely hollow, and they have what's called in literature a free-rolling cell. So what that means is that the cell that the actual larva lives in is not attached to the plant anymore. It just rolls around. So if you pick up the leaf and shake it, you can't actually hear it because it's too quiet. But if you open it up, you can see this little pellet rolling around inside with the larva in it. And most of the space of the gall is actually completely empty. As far as I'm aware, this is something that doesn't occur without the aid of an inducer in plants at all. It's maybe always possible. There's always exceptions in nature. But as far as I'm aware, this is something that an oak tree can only do because this wasp taught it how to do it. And I just blows my mind that they can, you know, create such a new ability to have this little loose pellet inside of another structure. That's remarkable to me.
I have no idea if this makes any sense to someone like yourself, who's an expert in the area, but I was just thinking about having that free rolling cell in there. And if there was a parasitoid that came along trying to like inject its own egg inside, that might make it extremely difficult. It would just push that free rolling cell away as opposed to actually being able to inject inside of it.
I think it's a reasonable hypothesis, but I have no evidence one way or another whether that's the reason that those occur. There are all sorts of galls in that genus that have free rolling cells, and some of them are much less hollow than this one, much less space in there. And I don't know if a significant strategy in that, or reason that strategy developed.
It's fun to think about anyway.
Absolutely.
And your third one.
Sure. So this is a third species that also is found on red group oaks in Michigan, and it's called Calaritis quercus gemaria. So these are little green cylinders, little ribbed cylinders that emerge in these really dense clusters in the spring along the stem or twig of red oaks, and they release honeydew. And so you'll often see these covered by ants that are collecting that honeydew. And we think that's in order to deter other wasps from coming in to oviposit on those galls. But in this case, there is at least one other wasp that successfully bypasses that security mechanism and lays its eggs in there. We think that this is a Synergis species, another cynipid wasp. And so if these galls get oviposited by the Synergis wasp, they completely change their developmental trajectory. So instead of dropping onto the forest floor like they normally would, they stay on the tree, they get much bigger, and they get almost woody, and they stay on there for months, and they look completely different than what otherwise. And so that's, I guess, what I find interesting about those is that not only do you have the plant and the inducer, you then have this third organism, and only the three of them together can produce this outcome, this unique organ on the plant stem.
Yeah, it's just another kind of mind-blowing thing in nature that I think it would be so easily overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it absolutely has been.
Yeah, now we know to look for it. Here's a request I have for you. For each of these, do you have photos that you'd be able to share with me? I could put in the show notes for people to see.
Oh, of course. Yep.
Awesome. So yeah, I looked at all of them and they are all fascinating. So I highly advise people to take a look. So to wrap things up, I always have a few standard questions I like to ask. And one, of course, is what resources do you recommend for people who are interested in learning more about galls? We've talked about a whole bunch here today. So maybe this is just a recap. Maybe you have some other ones as well.
Sure. Yeah. So our website, Gallformers, is obviously my number one recommendation. Our goal is to make that site a one-stop shop for gall identification. So we're planning to include full passages from the primary literature whenever possible, so that it will not just be our information, but it will be all available information. So for instance, a lot of the older sources, like the Lewis Hart Weld cynipid books that he's written on the Eastern Pacific and Southwestern United States, those books are all completely redundant relative to our database. We have all of his information plus a lot more. But outside of what we have, there are definitely some useful books out there. Ron Russo is a California gall expert who recently published a new book. He had one previous older book, but he's a brand new book just came out this year called Plant Galls of the Western United States. That would be a definite must own for anybody in California, Oregon, Arizona. Charlie Eisman's blog has tons of great observations and interesting information about galls. Bug Guide, of course, although at this point, most of what they have is going to be on our site as well. If it's not, it will be soon. And then if you find yourself in a position where none of those resources get you the information you need, you can start looking in the Biodiversity Heritage Library for things that we haven't added to our site yet.
Yeah, and earlier you mentioned Charlie's other book, The Tracks and Signs of Insects and Other Invertebrates, and I'll include links to all of these as well, but that other book has a good overview on galls. Do you have any other upcoming projects that you'd like to highlight?
So at this point, we're just plugging away at filling in the site. So short-term plans are just to pick out another genus and find all the literature and put that onto the site. So I haven't actually decided where I'm going next. I just finished up with the new phylloxera on hickories and in between projects right now.
All right. And if people want to follow your progress or follow your work, where can they go?
Go to the website, golfwormers.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at golfwormers. And if you want to follow me personally on iNaturalist, my handle is MegaKyle.
And one thing we didn't really talk about on iNaturalist is there are a couple, for those listeners anyway, that do contribute observations, there are a couple of gall-oriented projects out there. There's at least the two that I contribute to. There's a California-specific one. And then one, I think that Charlie Iceman actually started, called Galls of North America.
And I think those projects are nested.
Okay.
So I think all of the California galls go into the North America project.
That's really good to know. That will save me some time.
Yeah. So if you're uploading an observation to iNat and you think it's a gall, but you're not sure what kind of gall, you can always just submit it to that project and someone will see it there at some point, whether it's in the short term or long term. You can feel free to tag me as well, and I will try to help you identify your galls.
Okay. Well, Adam, it's really been a fascinating conversation. I appreciate all the time that you've spent with me here today, and best of luck to you as Golfwormers fills out. I'll certainly do what I can to help out in making that the resource that you envision it to become.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for sticking through the entire episode. If you made it this far, I hope that it means that you enjoyed it. If so, please spread the word and share this episode with three friends or groups that you think would enjoy it too. As for today's episode, let me know, did I miss anything? Was there a topic I should have covered? Let me know at podcast@jumpstartnature.com or DM me on any of my social accounts. I'll do my best to answer your questions. You can find me at Nature's Archive, one word, on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I also share photography, nature stories, and much more on those accounts, so you can follow just to stay in touch, too. And despite being called crazy by numerous friends and colleagues, last year I left my tech career behind to start Jumpstart Nature, which Nature's Archive is now part of. For the sake of myself, my family, and the planet, I need to make this work. So please also consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/jumpstartnature. I offer some exclusive content and perks, and you can start donations as low as $4 a month. Lastly, please also check out our latest creation. It's the Jumpstart Nature podcast. We just completed our pilot season, where each episode reveals an unseen, surprising, or misunderstood nature topic with the help of experts and our host, Griff Griffith. It's entertaining and inspiring, and even reached number 3 on the Apple Nature podcast charts. There's much more on our roadmap, but we need your support. So check out jumpstartnature.com for more details. Thank you.